basically, this is a course in religious epistemology, so it's a course in the ways of knowing God. And since the object of religious knowledge is God, there are three basic ways of knowing God. We've generally been talking in terms of two, but there are three. One is by revelation. The second is by reason, and the third is by experience. William James falls into the last category and probably gives one of the greatest analysis of religious experience on record. Each of these, it occurs to me, has at least two ways of representing itself. Revelation will diagram from the top down, from God to man. And here I see two kinds of revelation, basically. The orthodox view is that there is propositional revelation. Propositional revelation, and of course all orthodox theologians will fall in that category. The neo-orthodox view is that there is personal revelation, and Bart, Brunner, Bultmann would all fall in that category. Then you can know God by way of human reason, and I'll draw these arrows going up from man toward God. And here human reason falls generally in two broad categories. There are proofs for the existence of God, or there is probable evidence. Some hold both, some hold one or the other. Then experience, which I think also the arrow should be going up because it's man experiencing God. There are two kinds of experience. There's mystical experience, which could be called special religious experience, things that people have on rare occasions. And then there's let's just call it religious experience, which is a general religious experience, which people really have all of the time. Tillich and William James, that we're studying today, will fall into that category. In fact, we might want to put some names. All of the orthodox theologians here, like Anselm, Augustine, and Aquinas, the AAA theist, as I call them, all fall in that category. The personal revelation is Bart, Bultmann, and Brunner. Too bad the next ones aren't all C's, isn't it? BBB. Proofs for the existence of God would also fall in the category of Augustine, Anselm, Aquinas, and all classical theists. Probable evidence for the existence of God, generally speaking, you could just say most of the people that we have studied. Mystical experience would be Plotinus, Meister Eckhart. Religious experience in general would be William James and Paul Tillich. And that pretty well summarizes the course. I want to first of all delineate the difference between the mystical experience and the general religious experience. A mystical experience is a special religious experience, such as the act of getting married, to use an illustration, whereas a general religious experience is the consciousness of being a married man. Now, I always have the consciousness that I'm a married man, even when I'm not thinking about it, because I am a married man. That is my status. So there's a sense in which I'm always conscious of being married, but there was a special event of getting married, which for me happened to be 35 years ago on June 24th, which is a special event. Now, that was a special experience, whereas my everyday experience of consciousness of being married is just a general experience. And that's the difference between a mystical experience and a general religious experience. Also, I should have put here Schleiermacher fits in the general religious experience. He He believed that it was a feeling of absolute dependence that you have all the time, a sense of contingency. Tillich felt it was an ultimate commitment. William James felt it was an awareness of some transcendence, but they all felt that this was a consciousness that you have with you all the time, and that's the most valid way by which people come to know God. It's available to everybody, and it's not cognitive, it's not propositional, it's precognitive and pre-propositional, namely experiential. With that introduction to William James, take a look at William James, the notes, Life and Works, 1842 and 1910, born in New York. James' parental grandfather was an Irish Calvinist who immigrated to U.S. His early education was in the spirit of New England transcendentalist and romanticist. Another way to say that is pantheist. So he was educated in New England pantheism. His literary associations with Oliver Wendell Holmes and Ralph Waldo Emerson, who were pantheists. He was sent to Europe to get a better sensuous education than he would in the U.S. His interests were divided between art and natural science. He got a medical degree. He taught physiology at Harvard, then psychology, then philosophy. Sooner or later, if you think long enough, you end up in philosophy, no matter where you start. His intellectual associates included Charles Sanders Peirce, looks like it should be pronounced Pierce, but it's pronounced Peirce. He was one of the first pragmatists. Josias Royce at Harvard, Santayana, and John Dewey, the father of modern instrumentalism. Henri Bergson, F.H. Bradley. James, however, was an original thinker. In fact, he's one of the few original American thinkers. His major works include The Will to Believe, Varieties of Religious Experience, which by any measure is a classic. That's one of those books that count yourself ignorant if you haven't read. It's the classic on this topic. Pragmatism, The Meaning of Truth, Pluralistic Universe, Essays in Radical Empiricism. His philosophy is summarized in one word, pragmatism. His philosophical pragmatism in general, the nature of pragmatism versus non-pragmatism, he felt that the difference between the non-pragmatists and his view was that truth for them was dogmatic, and he wanted to make truth pragmatic. He thought they understood it theoretically, and he wanted to understand truth practically, not in the abstract, but in the concrete. Reminds me of the father who put cement in his driveway and came out the next morning, saw his son's footprints in it, and he said, "I like children in the abstract, but not in the concrete." In contemplation, the non-pragmatist would say, but it's in action that he wants to find truth. He believed that truth is an open system, not a closed system, that you know truth by its effects, not found in its causes. Aristotle was looking for causes and said, "Now I've got the truth." William James was looking for effects. Aristotle or the Platonists were looking in the root of things. He wanted to find it in the fruit of things. Whereas the classical mind wanted rational necessity, he wanted experiential expediency. He believed the true is what is expedient in experience. He didn't find truth in universal or absolute. He found it both relative and particular. An important moment in the history of religion, the history of thought, the history of truth, almost anything, because the whole center of gravity shifts here. It shifts from the left column to the right column in the early 1900s, and this is the original American philosophy. You can't understand the American psyche if you don't understand William James, because Americans created pragmatism. With John Dewey's instrumentalism, also called pragmatism, and William James, they're the two original American philosophers. No other country in the world ever invented pragmatism, and we have exported it all over the world. The different uses of the pragmatic method. Charles Sanders Peirce used pragmatism for the clarification of ideas. William James for the verification of ideas, not just to understand but to test. Peirce said, if you want to clarify an idea, find out what its cash value is. How does it work out in experience? James said, if you want to verify, if you want to know if it's true or not, work it out. John Dewey, for the investigation of ideas. discovery. His whole idea was discovery and progress. It was a meliorism where you things are getting better and you should discover the progress. His philosophy of religion, a general description of religion for James. His concern is with personal religious experience, not institutional religious expression. Personal religion equals our feelings and acts insofar as we stand in relationship to the divine. Morality accepts the yoke of the universe, obedience, but religion welcomes it. Whereas morality calls for servants, religion calls for volunteers. Religion is more than escape. It is permanent overcoming by opening one's soul to the transcendent, that should be. It's not just an escape, as, for example, Freud would have said, a cosmic Linus blanket, a heavenly comforter, something to escape from the real world, but it's really a way of overcoming. And then William James gave his classic analysis of the two types of religious experience, the once-born type and the twice-born type. He psychoanalyzed all religious experience empirically, inductively, put them in two broad categories. He said, everybody falls into one of these two categories. Those who are optimistic in outlook are the once-born type. Those who are pessimistic are the twice-born. The once-born type maximize good. The twice-born type maximize evil. The once-born type are healthy-minded. The twice-born type, those who want to be born again, are the sick-souled type. The once-born are typical of Latins. The twice-born are typical of Germans. The once-born tend to be pantheist. The twice-born tend to be theist. The once-born are like Emerson and Whitman. The twice-born are like Luther and Bunyan. The once-born have no consciousness of sin, but the twice-born have a deep sense of guilt. The once-born are born with a sense of harmony. The others are born with a sense of inner discord. Once-born are find happiness is evidence of God. The twice-born say unhappiness shows the need for God. The once-born stress continuity with God, and the twice-born stress discontinuity. In the first category, man is only maladjusted. In the second, he is essentially evil. Man is curable naturally. In the once-born category, man needs supernatural help. In the second. One is built on a one-story universe of more good than evil. The other is built on a two-story universe where evil outweighs good. And James felt that you could explain everybody in the world in their religious experience. Everybody had one. It's just that they fall in different categories. There are two kinds of conversion, according to James, gradual and sudden. Now, conversion generally refers to the second category, the twice-born type are the ones that need to be converted. The first-born type don't need to be converted. They're just kind of born with this harmony, oneness with the universe. Both kinds are characterized by the following. Now, when he looked at it, he studied conversions, and he saw a pattern. All conversions have this pattern. A change in the habitual center of personal energy, self-surrender. One life system being undermined until it collapses and is replaced by another. Generally occurs in adolescence, but takes one-fifth the time by conversion. Most people will get this conversion in adolescence, but you can get it faster if you go through a so-called conversion experience. It'll take only about one-fifth the time. The symptoms are a sense of incompleteness, anxiety about the hereafter, and then a sense of happy relief. B, sudden conversion is characterized by a period of subconscious incubation. If you're the type of person that has a sudden conversion, then you were sublimating for a long time. You were repressing. We would say you were under conviction by the Holy Spirit, and you were pushing it down. That will be followed by an uprush from the subconscious called automation. The larger the subconscious, the more likely there will be a sudden conversion. There is no psychological difference between natural and supernatural conversions, as Jonathan Edwards said. Now, the other great treatise on religious experience is Jonathan Edwards' Religious Affection. And if you want to read the other side of the story, a great supernatural description of it by another brilliant mind, an early American, you want to read Edwards, where Edwards disagrees with James and says there are certain characteristics of a supernatural conversion that you don't get. in natural conversion. James is naturalizing it all. No, James does not deny the possibility that God could be working through the subconscious. In fact, he admits this. He says, this is just a psychological description of what occurs. I don't deny that there's a God who's working through it. I'm just saying that from a psychoanalytic point of view, that's where I identify it in the person that's coming from. The value of religion is judged by its fruits. How do you know whether your conversion, gradual or sudden, or for that matter, non-conversion, is a good experience? Fruits. By their fruits you shall know them. Saintliness is what he calls the fruit of religion. Saintliness is the same for all religions. You could look at Buddhists, Hindus, I don't care what you study, James says, and they all have the same characteristics. There are inner characteristics and outer. The inner ones are a feeling of being in a wider ideal life than this world's selfish interest. A sense of friendly continuity between oneself and this ideal power. An immense sense of freedom and elation as our confining self melts down. A shift of our emotional center toward love and harmony to the claims of the non-ego, the other, the more, the transcendent. The outer manifestations of religious experience are asceticism, where self-surrender becomes self-sacrifice, strength of soul, the enlargement of the soul to new reaches of patience and fortitude, purity, a spiritual sensitizing resulting from the shift of our emotional center, and charity, the same shift brings increased tenderness to our fellow creatures. His evaluation of saintliness is, on the whole, saints are superior. Just the opposite of Nietzsche, who said saints are weak. William James replies by saying, Cromwell was weak, Joan of Arc was weak. They were hardly weak. He said saints are some of the strongest people who ever lived in the world. Furthermore, sainthood is not infallible. Saints are narrow in their cultural blindness. He didn't use this illustration, but he would have said in response to the liberals who say, why is it that in the where Christianity was at its most fundamental, Bible-believing apex, it was also the most racist South United States. That's a typical liberal charge to evangelical Christians. And James' response to that would be, saints aren't perfect. They have cultural blinders, too. You could be a sincere saint and still have cultural blindness and be a racist or own slaves, as Thomas Jefferson did, and many other Christians did, for that matter. The larger, then he goes on to say, thirdly, saints are not necessarily weak or otherworldly. Some were strong and thisworldly. In fact, he has a great line in his book that goes something like this, that no one has set a fire in this world who hasn't been set on fire from another world. That the people who have really accomplished the most in this world are people who have been in touch with the transcendent. They had a vision, they had something from beyond that impelled them to do. You know, whether Paul, the love of Christ constrains me, or Isaiah seeing a vision of God, or Joan of Arc. That leads us to five, the nature and value of mystical experience. The nature of a mystical experience, an ineffability that is directly experienced but is inexpressible. A noetic quality or knowing state that is above discursive reasoning. Discursive reasoning is reasoning from premises to conclusions, like a syllogism. Often there is transiency lasting 1/2 to 2 hours. That's the normal time period of this ineffable special experience. Passivity, or sense of being grasped by a superior power, though by prior voluntary acts that brought you to the place that you were grabbed by this power. Note, drugs or nature may, that should be M-A-Y, may evoke mystical experience, but meditation is the usual way. There are some people that get this by drugs. Even James knew in his day, certain Indian religions. We have one, the native Indian religion in America that uses drugs that every once in a while.
Peyote.
Yeah, and that's been part of native religions for years. It's still part of voodoo and part of many primitive or so-called preliterate religions. Then he says, what mystical experience does not prove? Mystical states are absolutely authoritative over those who have them, but no duty emanates from them to make it the duty of others to accept their revelations. They prove there is another kind of consciousness beyond the sensual and the intellectual. They dethrone the exclusive claims of rationalism and empiricism. So James had a kind of halfway house there. On the one hand, he admitted the validity of a mystical experience. On the other hand, he wouldn't let it go beyond the individual to have any apologetic value for someone else. So if I came to you and said, I had a mystical experience that told me we should do X, you had every right to say, I respect your experience, I think you did, but it doesn't have any authority on me.
Was William James, wasn't he like the father of behaviorism, psychology? I'm just trying to remember.
The father of behavioralism, I don't know.
I think he came before Skinner.
Well, he came before Skinner for sure. Skinner's contemporary and James is early 1900s,
right,
he was the same.
I think he kind of was the one that started that movement in psychology.
May have, I'm not sure.
Pavlov
definitely in terms of stimulus response.
I don't know that.
James wouldn't fit into, if he were, he would not fit into a rigid behavioralism. I can tell you that from what I know about him. Okay, the common core of religious experience, 6, the subjective side. And the objective side. Here's what he believed was common to all religious experience, whether Christian or non-Christian, whether once born, twice born. This is the common denominator that he can put in propositional form. On the subjective side, the emotional and practical, a feeling that the visible world draws its chief significance from the wider spiritual universe. See, that include a pantheist and a theist. That union or harmonious relations with the higher universe is our true end. That prayer or inner communion, that'll take care of theism and pantheism, with the spirit of this higher universe produces effects within the phenomenal world. Prayer does change at least people, if not things. The effects of this, of the former, are a new zest for life manifest either in lyrical enchantment or an appeal to earnestment and heroism. 5, an assurance of safety and a temper of peace in oneself and love to others. That's what a religious experience is. Everybody from Hindus to born-again Christians have that same basic psychological pattern. The objective side, here's the only intellectual content, propositional content he can give to this. A sense that something is wrong about us and the way we are naturally, and that we are saved from this wrongness by making proper connection with higher powers. That's kind of a watered-down gospel, to be sure, but that's the best he could come up with from a purely naturalistic standpoint. The test of James' hypothesis about religion. He admits there is no objective or scientific proof for what he's just said. But its experiential fit is so plausible that scientific logic will find no good reason to veto it, and our religious impulse will welcome it as true. The hypothesis is this: whatever the more or higher non-ego may be on the farther side, which we can't get to directly by experience, on the hither side, on my experiential side, it is the subconscious continuation of our conscious life. Whatever more there may be to God, and that he's going to later call over-beliefs, we do know here in these under-beliefs, the things we can empirically verify, that it's the subconscious continuation of our conscious life. However, James goes on to say, over-beliefs are very important. That is what we can't experientially verify. The farther side of religious experience is a matter of over-belief. These overbeliefs, strangely, are the most important thing about us. These beliefs cannot be justified rationally, but only pragmatically and volitionally. The will to believe. And if it works, it's true. The will to believe means that in all genuine options, and a genuine option is defined namely as a living, forced, and momentous one, we have a right to believe that our own risk for our own, believe at our own risk for our own good. You have every right to believe what you want. You can use your will to believe. And religion is a forced option. It is a momentous belief. So you have the right to will to believe what you want to believe. It is an insane logic not to believe where faith can help create the fact. And if you don't believe, you won't get these benefits from it. So psychologically, it makes sense to believe. We have the right to risk faith in any sensible view that is live enough to tempt our will. And if you're tempted to be a theist, even though that's an overbelief, you can't empirically verify it, you can't prove it pragmatically, you have every right to will to believe in theism. And if that changes your life and gives you inner harmony and outer peace, people, then help yourself. James' personal overbeliefs were a finite God, immortality of the soul, and a melioristic world, meaning one that's getting better and better. That's his personal overbeliefs. No, finite God is a theistic concept of God minus omnipotence.
George Burns.
George Burns. I didn't see it, but I saw enough things for it. That's probably it. Probably
it. Omniscient.
Not necessarily. No, finite means limited, and it's always limited in power. It could be limited in other respects too. Usually limited in knowledge, but almost never limited in love. Most finite goddesses think God has unlimited love, but he's limited in power and limited in knowledge, and that's why he can't do more than he's doing in the world.
He's limited because he has created free agents and he has put himself on limitations?
No, limited because he's inherently limited by his very nature. He's not an infinite God. He's a finite God.
But he has existed eternally and...
He existed eternally and he created the world and he created the world freely. And he has a personality and intellect and power. And in the history of thought, Plato had a finite God. William James, John Stuart Mill, Reitman, Bertacci, right on up to Kirchner, the Jewish rabbi that I debated on the John Ankerberg show, Rabbi Kirchner, when bad things happen to good people. All of those people were finite goddesses. Oh, he's not making a, no, he made no value judgment there. If the tone of my voice or something I said led you to believe that he thought those were better, that's wrong. That's simply descriptive. There's no prescriptive statement there at all.
Well, the characteristics in the cells seem to make the once moon a lot better.
Yeah,
sure.
We've got
the twice moon, we've got these pessimistic, maximizing evils, sort of people.
That's just the way it is. That's just the way it is.
Guilty.
Some people have personalities like that. Schuller would be once born. Schuller's definitely once born. Quote, Jesus never called any man a sinner and I'm not going to either, end quote. He's a once born evangelical evangelist, which is a kind of oxymoron in itself, isn't it?
It's funny, Christianity Today, when they were like critiquing the book, The Agony of the Sea, they showed his picture and they were mocked and deserted and saying Schuller is an evangelical, you shouldn't put his picture with this other guy.